Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. Today, I have an amazing discussion about God. After researching Dr. John Lilly, one of my very favorite books is his discussion of God in a book called Simulations of God, The Science of Belief. One of the primary tenets of this podcast has turned out to be a discussion of God. If you go back and listen to my first episodes, I didn't try to use the word God and then found that it was impossible not to. God is a fundamental part of the discussion of the reality creation of spirituality and what God is. And it has developed through the Neville Goddard literature and the Law of One literature and the Joseph Murphy that I am God. And then we talk about what does that mean when I say I am God. And I have done episodes on this. We recently had an amazing episode from Alan Watts where he talks about the fact that I am God. And it is amazing. I love to read what other amazing authors say when thinking about God because it's a universal discussion. It's something we all think about, talk about. I think we're entering into the vibration of God, and God is everything. What John Lilly did in his book, Simulations of God, he discussed God from different perspectives. God as the beginning, I am God, God out there, God as a her or him or it, God as a group, God as orgasm and sex, God as death, God as drugs, God as the body, God as money, God as righteous wrath, or compassion, or war, or science, or mystery, as the computer simulating himself, as humor, as superspace, as the ultimate simulation, as the dyad. What is God? In each of these discussions, I found very powerful, in particular his discussion of the I am God concept and what God is. Now, Dr. John Lilly, if you have not heard of him, was super amazing and fascinating. And if you were to pick up any of his books, you will be blown away by them. John Lilly, who died in 2001, was an American physician, a neuroscientist, a psychoanalyst, a psychonaut, a philosopher, a writer, an inventor. He was a member of a generation of counterculture scientists and thinkers that included Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, and Werner Erhard. They were all frequent visitors to his home. He was good friends with Ram Dass. He often stirred controversy among mainstream scientists, and he conducted high-altitude research during World War II and trained as a psychoanalyst, and he became famous for developing the isolation tank. He saw that tanks in which users are isolated from all external stimuli as a means of exploring the nature of human consciousness. And if you've ever sat in an isolation tank, then you'll know that John Lilly was the one that really started doing this. And he started experimenting using these isolation tanks with psychedelics and LSD. And he later combined his work with communicating with dolphins in isolation tanks. He began to study how bottlenose dolphins vocalize and establishing centers in the Virgin Islands and San Francisco to study them, claiming that they were intelligent. His discussion of dolphins as another level of evolution is really fascinating. He began to experiment with LSD in flotation, and there are two movies you can check out about John Lilly. The Altered States, which is the classic with William Hurt, that movie is absolutely crazy. And The Day of the Dolphin, another interesting movie directed by Mike Nichols. George C. Scott is also based on John Lilly. And he wrote some amazing books. And in particular, he wrote a book called The Simulations of God. And his discussion of God in particular is expansive. So try to expand the way you view God and view God from different angles, from above and below, as different things, and you expand your understanding of what God is. The definition of God and the beginning depends upon our definition of ourself, of ourselves, according to Lilly, stating, assume all along with modern consensus science, the ordinary science of today, that we began as primordial molecular configurations in the primeval seas of a planet with an atmosphere, and that eventually we evolved into colonial protozoans, which then became various kinds of sea animals, which then became fish, which then climbed out onto land, became reptiles, eventually to evolve into mammals, then on through the simian line, and finally into the larger-brained mammals that have dubbed themselves Homo sapiens. Alternative origins postulate a divine creation of man, separate from the rest of our planet and separate from the rest of the biology of the planet. A version with angels, or Christ, or Yahweh, with some sort of intelligence, with various divine attributes, which created us as a special case. These are extreme systems of belief, and of course, there are many others. God is assumed to be some form of intelligence, which either set up evolution as it exists, or with a divine touch wrought out of nothing, instantaneous creations that became self-reproducing. Those who claim that they know God, that they are of God, that they are men and women of God, and that God speaks directly through them to the rest of us, tell us through their writings and their speeches and their ways of life that God always was, always has been, is everywhere, and always will be. We are told that He is omnipotent, omniscient, all-loving, and all-merciful. But we are told that He speaks through the limited instruments who claim they know Him. I've explored these spaces myself. I have gone into the belief systems summarized above. I've lived out for days, hours, and weeks these beliefs and the experiences consequent upon them. Then retired from each of the systems, contemplated the results in myself and in those around me, in my changed view in external reality. In summary, I find that if one constructs beliefs and lives them out, he sets up a theater and a play within that theater, and he himself is the author, the composer, the director, the actor, and the audience. This capacity of man's rather large brain is to be respected. It is a complex capability which should be understood. It should be understood that as one steps aside and looks at this capability and its performance in the actual flesh, that then he arrives at a pretty secure foundation within himself. He realizes that he is essentially alone, and that his contacts with and feedbacks from others are through rather limited channels, channels prejudiced by his own beliefs and by the beliefs of those with whom he is communicating. He can eliminate fear, guilt, and all the other negative aspects of existence. He can also eliminate all the positive aspects of existence and finally arrive at what Franklin Merrill Wolfe calls the state of high indifference. The state of high indifference is what I would call neutral reinforcement, a neutral state, neither punishing nor rewarding, a state of understanding, of knowledge, or jhana yoga, beyond ananda, beyond bliss, a state far removed from the trivial, primitive compassion of the usual sentimentality given in standard religions. If we pay close attention to our performances, we find that neutral reinforcement is actually the most rewarding state we can achieve. It is the state of total objectivity. It is the state of the objective observer, including objective observer observing himself as a peculiar system of consciousness and of energies functioning according to laws which he is yet to understand. He is surrounded with mystery within his own structure, body, or essence. In this state, all or any of these are seeking understanding and some way of avoiding, obliterating, or rewriting past misunderstanding. We observe what I have described here as the activity most valued by those in this state. God, then, is the beginning, and the beginning in self, The self is seeking its own beginnings and pushing those beginnings onto the universe as if it understood, as if the void gave birth in some intelligent fashion to that self, which can play games with its own origins and can ascribe to a God these origins, although in truth it cannot and will not know its own origins at this point. This is a grievous revelation, a grievous discovery. All the past comforts from other beliefs are gone. This, of course, is only another belief, a current one in this particular entity to know that one cannot know, that one does not know God as the beginning. It is a grievous for one to know that he can no longer be guilty, nor fearful, nor angry. It is grievous to know that he can no longer be sexually attracted, repelled, rewarded, nor punished in this state of neutral reinforcement, this state of high indifference. Even the grief is gone. One can no longer be grievous. One just is, as he is, as he has been, and as he expects. But is he never sure that he will always be? He approaches his end, once again getting out of the state of high indifference, contemplating the end of self. However, as he is, so he has been, will be, and may chance once again to appear, at least in some other form, at some future time. One can believe in eternity, but he cannot demonstrate eternity. He can experience eternity, but in the consensus reality, he cannot make a scientific demonstration that eternity exists. He can play the game as if he were God at the beginning, but again, he will realize that he is limited to a brain and a body which function at 310 degrees absolute, so he cannot go to the absolute zero of the void and become that which began before anything else, and he is a conglomeration of at least 26 billion neurons plus 10 to the n quantum operators, quantum observers in that nervous system. One can manipulate, function, program, and metaprogram this very complex system, but he cannot obliterate it. He cannot start over with it, cannot become a sperm and an egg meeting for the first time. One can play as if in his own theater of the absurd, of the sublime, of high indifference, but he cannot possibly know God as the beginning. I am God. There are many first-hand experiences described in the literature or by word of mouth in which a particular individual moves into an eternal space, outside time as we know it, outside the external reality as we know it, outside the body as we know it. The reports vary considerably among their authors, but their one common factor with which we wish to deal here is the feeling that one had no beginning and one will have no end. One in this sense would be eternal. There may also be an accompanying feeling, almost non-human, that one is merely an agent for an immense authority. I believe the following quotes from Merrill Wolf's Pathways Through to Space best exemplify the I am as mentioned above. But now we will speak further. He who can turn his back upon the utmost limit of individual desire comes within the sweep of a current of consciousness wholly beyond the action or lead of desire. Human vocabularies afford no terms for representing what governs or leads to movement or transformation here. But beyond the great renunciation is a compensation that places man where he is Lord, even over the first nirvana. It implants him on a level that is beyond rest, as well as beyond action, beyond formlessness, as well as beyond form. And this is the high indifference. He who abides on the plane of the high indifference may enter rest or action at will. But he remains essentially superior to both, since from that level both these are derived. There is a completeness, superior to that of satisfaction, from which satisfaction may be employed as an instrument, and not merely stand as a final goal. so rest can be blended with action and the balance remain unbroken. But the high indifference unites much more, for in it are blended at once all qualities, all dualities. It is the end and the beginning and all between. It is the physical as well as that beyond the physical. It is form as well as the formless. It spreads over and through all, not excluding time and space. It is the desire and the desire fulfilled. At this moment and forever, it transcends all renunciation, even the highest. Thus, the balancing compensation is fulfilled. Here, knowing and being are at once the same. Literally, here is the utter fullness, beyond the highest reach of the imagination. But there is such a region of authority, supreme over all below it, and this is the high indifference. In this state, I was not enveloped with satisfaction, but there was no feeling in connection with that fact of something having been lost. Literally, I now had no need of satisfaction. This state or quality rested, as it were, below me, and I could have invoked it if I had so chosen. But the important point is that on the level of the high indifference, there is no need of comfort or of bliss, in the sense of an active happiness or joy. If one were to predicate bliss in connection with the high indifference, it would be correct only in the sense that there was an absence of misery or pain. But relative to this state, even pleasurable enjoyment is misery. I am well aware that in this we have a state of consciousness which falls quite outside the range of ordinary human imagination. Heretofore, I have for my own part never been able really to imagine a state of so superior an excellence that it was actually more than desirable. And here I mean more, in the best possible sense. Within the limits of my old motivation, there was nothing that craved anything like this. And I do not find anything in man as man that would make such a craving possible. Yet now, deep within me, I feel that I am centered in a level from which I took down upon all objects of all possible human desire, even the most lofty. It is a strange, almost weird consciousness when viewed from the perspective of relative levels. Yet on its own level, it is the one state that is really complete or adequate. What there may be still beyond, I do not know. But this state I do know consumes all others of which I have had any glimpse whatsoever. The word indifference is not altogether satisfactory, but I know of no other that serves as well. It is not at all indifference in the negative or tamasic sense. The latter is a dull, passive, and inert quality, close to the soddenness of real death. The high indifference is to be taken in the sense of an utter fullness that is even more than a bare infinity. To borrow a figure from mathematics, it is an infinity of some higher order, that is, an infinity which comprehends lesser infinities. Others have experienced feelings or states similar to those described by Merrill Wolf. For example, one subject recently reported that he had just gone through an experience in which his feeling of having an external existence as being true was overwhelming to him. After he passed out of that state of consciousness into his normal everyday state, he became skeptical of that feeling and of that state of eternal being. This seems to be more common occurrence than most people are aware of. The setting aside of one state of consciousness in another state of consciousness, and the calling the second state of consciousness unreal, fantastic, imaginative, or self-programmed, is the usual course in such cases. If states of consciousness are self-programmed, then the basic question arises, which one of the states of consciousness is independent of the self-programmatic power of the individual? Is there any state of consciousness which is not self-programmed? To escape answering these questions, we appeal to others, to the consensus judgment about reality. And we say, if I cannot trust my own judgment of the reality of a given state of consciousness, then I must trust the judgment of others whom I designate as experts in these matters. Priests, psychiatrists, doctors, lawyers, politicians, statesmen, legislators, and so forth. One tends to fall back upon expert opinion, expert judgments, in order to escape the necessity of investigating the truth of one's own grasp of a given state of consciousness, of a given reality, of a given self-meta program. If one does not share with a given individual a particular belief system and a particular set of experiences having to do with that belief system, one tends to put down that belief system and that set of experiences as false, fantastic, imaginary, self-created, psychotic, or whatever. This program keeps recurring in my own experience and that of the most experienced of my colleagues. This essential problem seems to me to be as follows. First of all, let us assume that there are n different states of consciousness which I am capable of entering. And secondly, let us number these states of consciousness in an arbitrary way as state 1, state 2, and so forth to state infinity. 3. Some of these states are completely separate from one another, some overlap others, and some seem to be identical in the sense that the observer's attitude in the given state is the only change in the variables, i.e., I can be in a consensus reality, but my observer may take various attitudes or belief systems toward the consensus reality or any other state other than the consensus reality. 4. Thus, for heuristic purposes, we surround the observer with the elements and the parameters of his state of consciousness as if he were a central sphere, which we call the observer, surrounded by another sphere, which we call the state of consciousness. 5. The observer can be independently changed, as can the state of his consciousness. Each of these may be more or less connected to the external reality, which we will symbolize as a further sphere surrounding the state of consciousness sphere. In isolation, the latter sphere is attenuated to the point where it is unimportant, and we have only the two inner spheres, that of the self or the observer, and the state of consciousness. Here we assume that the parameters of the state of consciousness and its contents can be designated, and that the contents of the observer or his or her parameters also can be designated. 6. In the older terminology, the self-metaprogrammer is the central sphere, and the metaprogrammic space is the next sphere out. 7. For the purposes of experiment, we assume that the external reality with its programming is attenuated by either solitude, isolation, and confinement, or by the efforts of the observer in cutting off the external reality as is done with a hypnotic trance. 8. The observer now has many options. He can self-metaprogram the observer and his state. He can also self-metaprogram the state of consciousness, that part of the metaprogrammatic space available to him, which he is going to bring into his awareness. And 9. If he programs in an eternal space without a body, without this planet, the self-metaprogrammer will become a point within a continuum contains other points of consciousness similar to, greater than, or less than the observer himself. The parameters of this state of consciousness are that communication takes place between these point entities, that they program one another, that they necessarily be human entities, that they exist in a universe which is not referable to the physical universe in our everyday experience. In this particular space, there is no knowledge whatsoever that a body exists, that a brain exists, that an individual exists on a planet Earth, in a solar system, in a galaxy, in a universe, such as is described by science as we know it. And then 10, during the time that the observer is in this space, he feels eternal, that he had no beginning, that he will have no end, and that the other entities with which he is sharing the space are the same as himself in this sense. He can receive new information. He can, as requested, give information to other entities. This information concerns eternal factors of a network of such beings and their influences on one another. There is no matter in this universe. There are only communicational energies. There is light, but light not as we know it through perception by our eyes. There is light that contains the blessed state, the grace of God, the Baraka, or whatever other symbol one wishes to use to explain this kind of light. Insofar as I can make out from the writings on the subject and from my own experiences, the above is a meta program. I call it a meta program because I am now in my body in a consensus reality, talking to other entities who are also in bodies, reading books, and exchanging information in the planet side trip. I speak from the state in which I am communicating with other bodies, brains, people. I'm not speaking from the state given above. Therefore, as soon as I call it a metaprogram, I am assuming that my biocomputer created the experience. One of the basic postulates of the biocomputer view is that one lives within a metaprogrammatic space, part of which is self-constructed. For purposes of discussion, let us say that one starts in the above space and then moves into a space or state of consciousness, which we could call I am God. This particular simulation of God says, in effect, I am eternal. Even though my body has a limited span, the particular I that is eternal has certain properties, some of which are creative, creation of metaprograms, creation of matter, creation of energy, creation of determinacy in the indeterminate field. This entity has the property of setting up lines in hyperspace, of certainty on a submicroscopic substrate of indeterminacy. Thus, in the consensus reality space, in state 48, the mapping state, I visualize an entity which can, as it were, speak through my consensus reality, body, brain, and knowledge, and program itself. This entity is called the individual essence. From this particular point of view, the essence is, in reality, a connection with a network of information, of control, of creation. This essence has the property of creation. The self-metaprogrammer under this particular essence is the skeptic, the investigator in state 48. The essence takes over control of this particular self-metaprogrammer in state 6 and 3. The essence begins to exert his or her programmatic control in state 12. If the self-metaprogrammer then gives up the control to the essence of the whole system, it moves into 6. With or without memory of the position of the self-metaprogrammer. Side note, Lilly has a book called The Center of the Cyclone in which he numbers these states. If the self-metaprogrammer then gives up the control to the essence, the whole system moves into number 6, or with or without memory of the position of the self-metaprogrammer. It is this connection and this special state of consciousness in which there is a definite knowledge of reality connecting oneself more and more deeply into the whole and its hypothesized creator. In this state, there is a conviction that one is God, or at least a protuberance of the consciousness of God, or one is an agent of God while in the state. On return, as it were, from that state to the body and the self-metaprogrammer, there may be a reinsertion of the skepticism program as to the reality of the previous program. Here I am speaking in terms of the language of 48 and not in terms of the non-language states of 6 and 3. There are other variations on the I Am God meta program. There is that of the prophets in the Bible. There is that of Muhammad in the Quran. There is that of Oscar Ichazo and his conviction that he communicates directly with God. Apparently, many such experiences in the past of the human race have generated the Bible, generated the Quran, generated many other writings which refer to the feeling of immense authority which is now to be shared. The knowledge gained is to be shared with others, and in certain cases, the unbeliever is to be punished for his lack of belief in the truth. Human arrogance is not necessarily lacking in those who have returned from the above described spaces. If they have returned with humility, then the belief system is more that of the Buddhists, for example, whether it is Zen or the Chinese or Indian versions of the same belief. In these systems, I am God does not imply any arrogance. It implies a humble position with no needs on the planet side trip except enough to hold the body together and to teach, like a bodhisattva, the essential truth of the discovery of essence within each of us. No person then is greater than any other person. There are only degrees of knowledge of the human condition. With this distinction between the essence and self-metaprogrammer, one can see very rapidly in moving into a state that there is no preempting value placing human above all other entities that exist in the universe as we know it, and in universes we do not know yet. For example, specific cases in which humans assume in their arrogance that they are superior to, and hence justly predators of other species of the planet Earth. Concern man's treatment of the whales, the dolphins, the porpoises, and the elephants. Insofar as I can determine and have presented in other books, the mind of the dolphin, the human biocomputer, and the man and dolphin, the quality of the self-metaprogrammer in terms of its ability to handle complex abstract conceptual systems is a direct function of the size of the brain involved. The greater size of the mammalian brain directly accounts for the complexity of the programming and metaprogramming available to that brain. Therefore, according to this kind of hypothesis, the dolphins, whales, porpoises, and elephants, animals with a large brain size, has an alien type of intelligence comparable to, if not greater than, ours. The point of view was presented first in 1958, then it has been little indication that it has made inroads upon the thinking of the scientific establishment. There is evidence, however, that youngsters of today who have been exposed to these new ideas have accepted them as a new paradigm, a new set of metaprograms far less limited than the previous ones. The belief largely still held in the field of science and by the community at large is that on this planet, man, the human scientist, is at the top of the heap. This with no investigation of the criteria on which this opinion is based. Such defenses as, well, if these other animals are so great, why aren't they building the way we're building? Put oneself in the I am God position where science, knowledge, and the other species are concerned. What I do then is the be-all and end-all on this planet. I have demonstrated this because I can destroy the others. In fact, now I have the capability of destroying everything on this planet, including the planet itself. Therefore, I must be at the top of the pyramid of development. Therefore, the others are my prey, and I am justified in killing them for purposes of my industries, my survival, or my warfare. In this sense, then, the I am God position denies that there is any such thing as an essence, that there is any such entity. It denies that there is any connection between us and other species. It denies that there is any connection between us and the rest of the universe. It denies that there is a God. It denies that there is a star maker who has any knowledge of what humans do. This, in a sense, is the existential position without religion and without the kinds of experiences about which I and others have written. In other words, in order to make oneself God in the sense of he who controls our planet with nuclear power, chemical and biological warfare, and political means of exerting power within a very limited framework, one assumes godlike powers and believes there is nothing else but oneself and one's own species. With this belief system, the be-all and end-all is humanity. There is nothing on the planet comparable to humanity. All other species are potential victims of the human species. There are no unknowns in communication with either these species or at present undiscovered species elsewhere in our galaxy. This view is quite as dogmatic and dangerous as the view of the Catholic Church during the Inquisition, of the Mohammedans following Mohammed, of the hordes of Genghis Khan coming into Europe, or of Attila the Hun. Currently, the depredations in our disturbed ecology permitted by this point of view are endangering all humans and other species on our planet. I am God, in this limited sense, is a very dangerous assumption on which to operate. It is unbalanced, limited, and closed. It is not an open system of belief, nor of thought, nor of doing. The kinds of difficulties that this belief system can lead to were seen in the Senate hearings concerning the Nixon administration. If there is no accountability of the human species to the planet, or to the solar system, or to the universe, if the human species are isolates and their survival depends only upon themselves and upon nobody else, they cannot afford this arrogant belief system, their God would be too small. In other words, God, who is trapped by human belief systems and accountable within those systems, is really not large enough for the universe as we know it. With the proper belief systems concerning other species, concerning communication pathways, at presently unavailable to our science as we believe it and know it, I am God becomes a humanistic solipsism. Humanity stewing in its own juices, unable to see beyond nuclear weapons, chemical and biological warfare, industrial waste, pollution of the seas and the atmosphere, the killing of one another, and the preying upon all species on the planet. Man's inhumanity to man is a result of lack of knowledge of the states of consciousness, which I and others have described, and of lack of respect for the human potential as opposed to the human past. One thing I do know, and that is that my self-metaprogrammer does not believe that it is God. My self-metaprogrammer cannot say I am God. In every area in which my self-metaprogrammer has attempted to take that position, I have been taught, and very carefully taught by horrendous experiences, that my self-metaprogrammer is not omniscient, is not omnipotent, is not omnipresent, and is not the creator of the rest of the universe, nor is it the creator of itself. In my experiences with essence, I begin to feel a connection with a something far greater than I as a single human being, than all of humanity as we know it, much greater than this planet, this solar system, this universe, a something that does contact those humans who are willing to enter those states of consciousness in which contact is possible and probable. We are learning some of the parameters, some of the self-metaprograms which lead to connections of these kinds. I myself maintain a certain skepticism until I can demonstrate unequivocally that which I know to be true, can demonstrate it to those open-minded skeptics who are willing to try the experiments that I and others have tried. I feel that we are now on the threshold of being able to demonstrate the phenomena we have discovered to those who will listen and to those who will experiment. The human software for changing belief systems, expanding them, opening them up, and incorporating the unknown as a part of our belief system is becoming available. The investigation of this human software is a proper science expanded beyond the current so-called natural sciences, within the sciences of mathematics, of theoretical physics, and of states of consciousness. When one projects God as if outside himself and believes this projection to be true, it is true. One of the inner reasons for making this projection may be that one is not ready yet to take the responsibility of being God, being in God, being in the universe, being derived from it and from Him. It is convenient to project one's God and say that He is a source of causation, a source of certainty, a reducer of indeterminability, and hence the creator of oneself and of the universe. This hypothesis has several advantages over assuming that one is participating in a universe which is God and in which oneself is God. One can lay the trip on someone else. One can say that this is not a program that I am following. I am following it because of a belief in this or that group, or who say that it is the way to believe, or in the external world, as if it itself were God. In shamanism, Carlos Castaneda's Don Juan is an example. The spirits, the causes, the gods are out there to be appropriated, to be prayed to be made sacrifices to conjure up, to bring out of hiding. Various techniques are used for these purposes: lack of sleep, prolonged physical vigils, prayer mandala, verbal rituals, special plants, and so forth. The techniques are essentially simple, easily taught, and easily learned. Their effectiveness depends upon the belief they are effective. If one does not have this belief, the techniques do not work. In order to conjure mescalito, Castaneda was asked to go through certain rituals with peyote. His visions were then subjected to an analysis by the shaman, and an interpretation was made of whether or not he had seen and experienced the presence of mescalito. This is a very good example of the creation of a god by means of an expectation program and a psychedelic plant. Peyote cactus, since many people have been using various psychedelic plants and chemicals, their particular effect no longer seems a miracle. Hundreds of thousands of persons have been able to perform this particular sleight of hand under the influence of psychedelic substance. The creation of a pillar of light or of some sort of monster or of God, the creation of anything that one wishes to create, can be achieved if the dose of the psychedelic is sufficiently large and the subject has been properly prepared in the proper surroundings. Shamanism in some form is now practiced by literally hundreds of thousands of people who have no shaman. Anyone can create a god out there of his own construction and shape it in any way he pleases. Anciently, the use of psychedelics might have been the major origin of the god out there, i.e., through the use of Amanita muscaria, the peyote cactus. cannabis sativa and its derivatives, and LSD-25, and various mushrooms, roots, and trees used throughout the world for these purposes currently today. There is evidence that these plants have been employed in shamanism for several hundreds, if not thousands, of years. According to Gordon Wasson, Amanita muscaria is the soma of the Vedas. The Vedas have a history of several thousand years, and most of their best writing might have resulted from experiences with one or another of these plants quite early in these years. The Bible of Judaism and Christianity and the Quran of their offshoot, Mohammedism, support the traditional dogma of these religions. If one reads these documents very carefully and looks into oneself and at the shamanism in the world today, there seems to be very little difference between the trips recounted in the Bible and modern psychedelic drug trips. With the knowledge of previous psychedelic spaces in one's own personal experience, there is nothing left that is surprising in the revelation to St. John. It is pretty obvious that he had been off on several trips of one sort or another and recorded what had happened, as is a person today. He was pre-programmed into certain spaces by his culture and his own expectations. This part of the Bible, which used to be an embarrassment to some Christians, now turns out to be the most modern part. A description of a psychedelic trip with or without the aid of plants or chemicals. In these particular religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Mohammedism, the God out there is seen to be a dichotomous God. He has an opponent, the devil, or Satan, or Shaitan, in Mohammedanism. Once again, we know that there are ecstatic trips which have been described in the Bible and other places, and there are also hell trips, see Dante's Inferno. We know that on a psychedelic chemical, one can experience much of what Dante describes, much of what is in the Bible, plus much more from the current science fiction, for example. The God of Wrath, the God of Love, and all the other names by which the Christian Jewish God has been called are projections of individuals and of a culture of their God onto the universe, acting as if causes were outside them. This error can easily be made on psychedelic chemicals, for one can mistake one's own construction and mental projections for real persons, happenings, and causes when they are merely programs with one's simulation space. This kind of error apparently was not well known when the Bible or the Quran were written, but it has been sharply clarified in the Western world during the last 100 years. The facts of hypnosis, of psychoanalysis, and so on arm us for this kind of phenomenon, projection of one's own simulations outside oneself as true. This means that if we need miracles, we will create miracles. In the region of the laws of thought, in the province of one's own mind, miracles can be created easily if one is confident that he can do so. Miracles outside the province of the mind are something else. They require, at least in our Western world, a little more work and planning and a cooperative effort among many people. An outgrowth of God, as out there, is science, as out there. The natural science came directly from this same projection of one's own simulations onto the external world as if real. This meant that for consensus, one appealed to groups so that religions became organized and grouped up around the true believers. Rather horrifying things were done to those who were heretics or who stated that they didn't believe any of this was going on. People were drawn and quartered, hanged and burned, suffered various other of man's inhumanities to man, pursued in the name of God out there, my God out there that I know and that I'm going to teach you about, or I will be forced to torture you until you do believe in my God. If you die during the torture, we will pray that your soul will go to heaven. One of the basic characteristics of the modern versions of these religions is the I am right banner they fly. Each one of them claims to be the truth, the only truth, and nothing but the truth. They will damn persons with differing beliefs on the basis of what they consider the truth of their own belief. They will proselytize. They will exert political pressures. They will, in general, act as if God is out there. Among the younger generation today, there is a tendency to create a new God out there called ecology or organic food or natural living and so forth. This movement is in reaction to the many poisons being used in order to save our food supply from other species. It is also based upon a disenfranchisement with the well-organized, well-running establishment which generates not only that which we need, but also that which we do not need, the latter in great quantities. The Back to Nature movement postulates that civilization, particularly its cities, are bad. The nature in the raw is where we should be, and that should scatter our populations over the face of the earth, demolish the cities, require everyone to grow his own food, outlaw all methods of mass production and mass distribution. Back to nature. This seems to be another version of God out there, worshiping a particular kind of ecology merely because it is not what humanity has generated, is another form of subtle projection. This God out there attitude generates what I call revelation from without. In this version, one's own projections, as it were, talk back to oneself and reveal to oneself the truth. In reality, this truth is inside oneself. Moses, however, had to go up the mountain and through the whole business of the Ten Commandments and the tablets and God in order to bring about a change in the Jewish way of life, which he internally knew was necessary with the kinds of things the Jews were then doing to one another and to their neighbors. It was high time somebody set up some kind of code. But for the code to have authority, it had to come from a revelation from without rather than a revelation from within. Moses claimed that God had carved the tablets on the top of the mountain. His ideas had been put into the words carved into those tablets. Moses himself was merely the agent that carried the tablets down the mountain and presented them to his people. Because of the belief systems of the Jews of that time, this was the only way Moses could get this new code accepted. Up until the time of Christ, revelation from without kept recurring among the prophets, special professional revealers of the truth, as transmitted directly from God. Christ himself did not believe in revelation from without. He believed in revelation from within. So far as one can deduce from reading some of the more modern translations of the Gospels, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so forth, one gets the feeling that God out there had lost by the time of Christ. He had came back again later, of course, with Peter and Paul and the other disciples. So far as my own experience is concerned, I feel that Christ taught self-transcendence and that one is the Son of God and one is God directly. Dostoevsky makes this point very strongly in the chapter The Grand Inquisitor in the Brothers Karamazov. There is a very special form of God out there which also includes God inside in a very peculiar sort of way, and that is in the Taoism of China. This is a very pragmatic, practical kind of spiritual system in which the way, the Tao, is revealed to one through the here and now, instantly, continuously, as long as one allows this to happen. One is in tune with the way when one is in the way, as it were. What the way is and where it comes from is not very clear. It may come from within the human body and from within the collective human body. It may be a mental construct or it may be a direct revelation from some being greater than human. Taoism denies any separation between living the planet-side trip and one's religion, one's spiritual system. The two are inseparable to the Taoist. If it's operational, it's true. One problem with the general assumption that God is out there and not inside and everywhere is that one must finally appeal to an outside force, an outside entity, an outside energy source for what we call love. It reinvigorates old conflicts having to do with being born into triadic relationship. Our very first triangle consists of each one of us, our mother and our father. This places dyadic strains on the newly born infant. The infant has two dyads, one each with father and with mother. However, there is a third dyad that is beyond the reach of the infant, the one between mother and father. In the resulting maneuvering that can take place with most parents, there develop certain rules in the infant's biocomputer for obtaining love from a loved person. These rules happen to be unique and peculiar to the two individuals, the mother and the father that the child happens to have been born to. This primal preliminary kind of programming that goes on with each one of us then leads to expectations of the receipt of love from external entities under certain conditions. One's behavior corresponds to a certain set of criteria which he has deduced as existing between his mother and himself, or another set pertaining to his own love. If one then projects his God out there in response to a dogmatic tradition of some sort, or in response to his own need, then he must follow certain rules in order to obtain divine love from his God out there. One may interpret love here as favors, material acquisitions, desired changes in one's character, for example. Whatever one can conceive as being in the province of love is in that province. In this view, then, one might say, God, grant me, poor, little, unique me, thy grace and thy love. Be on my side in my agonistic battles with other humans and with other species. Take my side. It is the righteous side, according to my own judgment. Therefore, thou should support my side, thus making it right and full of divine love. Thus we have those who do not believe in their God and who are beyond the pale in regard to receiving his love, his favors. Through the two world wars, we heard public prayers uttered by public figures that God would take our side and would wrathfully excoriate our enemies. We may rather completely project onto God out there our own systems of thinking, our own systems of feeling, and our own systems of doing, expecting intervention when we wish for intervention, expecting love when we wish for love. God out there is expected to fulfill the needs of the individual and of the collective human mind. There have been episodes in which mystics have contacted a state of being which gives them a new appreciation and a new perception of reality and eternity. Some of these mystics have tended to project this as if a God out there, others have not. The primary phenomenon of the experience, which in the Christian tradition is called the experience of divine grace or the experience of divine love, in the Arabic tradition, the experience of divine baraka, are taken as perceptions which validate the particular points of view, philosophies, and needs of those individuals with particular belief systems. They assume that what they do gives rise to the phenomena. This is not necessarily true. There may be among some of the ways of thinking, feeling, and doing clues to what it is they do that provokes these phenomena, from either within or without. At this point, we are not taking sides on the sources of these phenomena. We are merely noting that these phenomena are very real, but they are also overvalued in the sense that they then extend into proofs of belief systems. Here we do not wish to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We are not here putting down the phenomenon of divine love or divine grace or divine baraka, of higher states of consciousness and so forth. These phenomena in my own experience and those of many of my acquaintances are incredibly important to us. All we are calling to attention here is that if one forms the basic belief that these phenomena originate from a God out there, from the results of one's use of rituals directed to a God out there, and from prayer to a God out there, then one is not exploring all the possibilities. Rather, he is allowing possibilities to be only those dictated by some dogma from the past. Lily goes on to talk about God identifying within gender as a him or her, as death or drugs, as the body or money, and they're all amazing discussions of God from this perspective. The idea is we should continue to talk about this stuff. I don't claim absolute knowledge of anything. I am just trying to provide you an outlet for that curious mind that's like mine, that wants to think about this stuff, that wants to explore the concept and ideas of God and what it means. We've talked about it in many different ways, and I thought this would be another good addition to this discussion. I highly recommend reading John Lilly's books in specific reference in relation to our idea of the simulation. Lilly wrote a book called Programming and Metaprogramming in the Human Biocomputer, and it really explores using the human biocomputer of the mind and nervous system and programming it and creating programs that program, metaprograms, and exploring the nature of our own programming using this concept as a way of programming our reality. This is written before neurolinguistic programming. This is written in the early 70s. And I think it's fundamental reading if you are interested in the scientific basis behind reality creation as a form of internal programming and metaprogramming. But here, we can understand that God is like a program, a metaprogram, and understanding it from this perspective is highly beneficial and helpful in our expansion of knowledge of God, our Creator. Is He out there or is He in here? To me, my answer is both. You can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.